First thing I want to do is I want to thank Linda, Howard, and Leon for helping us put this whole thing together. They've been instrumental in getting it together. I wish we had more people, but we'll do what we can. First heard about Phil, I guess, in the media, and then I'm part of a book club, and we're reading his book. And Linda appropriately titled this little presentation, Neutering National Security, which is a good image if you think about a cow or whatever, neutering. It's that, 'cause that's what's happening. So I don't want to take too much time away from Phil. All the food is here. The bathroom is, you go out left, and it's on your right. Phil will be signing books at the end and selling books. And I'll turn it over to Phil because he tells the story a lot better than I ever could.
Well, everybody.
Hello.
Hello.
I'm curious how many people here have been involuntarily upgraded to Windows 10?
Involuntarily
upgraded. What a schmozzle that is, right? Well, my wonderful computer has decided that now, it's exactly this moment, is the time it needs to be updated. So it's spinning through the update process like espresso coffee. And it may or may not decide to be done before we're finished. So it's on 2% right now. It says, working on updates. That's nice to know. It's kind of like Caltrans, you know, they're working on the roads. 2%. Don't turn off your PC. In other words, don't turn off your political correctness. This will take a while. So that's very reassuring. It'll take a while.
I don't know why we lost the signal.
Because it's updating.
Oh, the computer lost it. It's not the disk. Okay.
Confounded contraption.
Okay. You have our sympathy for this.
Yes, we can have a moment of silence. So I can wing it.
Yeah.
Let's start out by a question. Let's just reverse the whole process. Why don't somebody just ask me a question? And if this thing comes online, then we'll run through the slides too. But meanwhile, you want a question?
I have a question.
Okay.
Yeah, I've just read the first part of your book, and I get the impression that you had spare time on your hands, and because of your spare time on your hands, you decided to start on and create this paper that wasn't required of you from your work. What motivated that?
Well, let me see if I can put it in context. I never have spare time. I have considered time to be more valuable than gold. I never waste time. And if you're referring to the last part of the career when I was on involuntary sabbatical, or
no, I think you were still working. You may have, they were moving you from agriculture to CBP at that
right.
time.
Oh, that's right. At that point, that was when I was the scheduler. Anybody here ever been in human resources, worked on a work schedule? It's a great way to get to know everybody that you work with. And one teeny little change, like Joe Blow decides he's going to call in sick today, sets off a chain reaction. And you have to reconfigure the entire schedule. Anyhow, I worked with two other colleagues. Remember that DHS was founded, Department of Homeland Security, was founded as an official agency in March of 2003. And Customs and Border Protection is one of 22 sub-agencies underneath DHS. CBP itself was made up of three previous agencies. By the way, how's it sound?
Good.
Everyone can tell. I hope the camera can.
And what were the other three agencies?
Immigration, Customs, and Agriculture. Believe it or not.
It was CBP, ICE, and
ICE?
USCIS.
ICE is not part of CBP, actually.
No, not separate.
Yeah. But the immigration officers, if anybody remembers from traveling prior to 9/11, immigration officers that stamped your passport wore black and white uniforms just like you. Except they had a badge.
I feel naked.
And meanwhile, the customs guys, they weren't armed either. Meanwhile, the customs guys that you might have encountered downstairs after having your passport stamped was the ones that inspected your bags or took duty. And then there were the guys in the agriculture side who might have run your bags through the x-rays to see if you had any contraband apples from Nicaragua or, you know, clandestine bananas or any of that kind of stuff like that. Or parakeets stuffed down your socks or any of them. Or reptiles from Madagascar, you know, lemurs with a bit part in the Disney movie. We got to move it, right? So all that stuff, that's what agriculture did. So when they merged together, they pulled 1,200 individuals out of what? A little tiny subsection of USDA, U.S. Department of Agriculture. By the way, if you look on the Amazon website, I've got like hundreds of reviews, and there's like 13 of them that are negative. And every one of them almost says that there's too many acronyms in the book. And that they can't follow it. And that's their criticism. And that, it's a wonderful book. Mr. Haney really knows what he's talking about, but there's too many acronyms, so I'm going to give you 1 star for that. So it's weird, you know. Anyhow, I did my best to make it as straightforward as possible. You know, but you cannot leave out all the acronyms and still talk about it.
Excuse me, but you have, right at the beginning of your book, the list of all the acronyms.
You noticed.
Yeah. I start at the beginning of a book.
Yeah, it's always, you know.
Oh, I do that too.
The very best place to start is Sound of Music. Start
yeah. Yeah, yeah.
The beginning. It's right there.
The very
place. Sound of Music.
How do you solve a problem like Sharia? It's up to 13%. I have to tell you guys, I'm really glad to be here, by the way. And that, how you doing? Thanks for coming. That humor is still legal. So you belong to him, right?
Right.
And I don't know, my persona on TV, I'm pretty serious. It's a very serious subject. But I used to tell people that my cruise control personality is 50% Clark Kent and 30% Steve Martin and 20% Chuck Norris. There are certain things that turn me into Chuck Norris. Human trafficking, sexual slavery, and Islamic jihad. Then I turn into a monster, you know, because I have a core of steel. I'm easygoing. Ask who was it that said they underestimated me? Bush? Was it the second Bush said that? They misunderestimated me.
Misunderestimated.
Oh, yeah.
So I was known as the guy with the white hair by the people that I interviewed. I was known throughout the entire Islamic world. Anybody that came to America, that came to Atlanta, watch out for the guy with the white hair, because you may not get in if you meet him.
What year was that?
Well, that was through my whole career. See, you know that what I used to do first was an entomologist, and I'm a UC graduate. I went to Davis, entomology. In the early 70s, when the science of biological control was just emerging, it started here in California. And I was the first generation of them at UC Davis. That was my alma mater. And then I went to graduate school at UC Riverside. I was born in Ventura County. I'm a California native. So it's nice to be back in my home state, although I have to admit, I'm confused. Remember Moonstruck at the very end when the grandpa was started crying with all this nutty drama that was going on? Everybody stops. Grandpa, what's wrong? I'm so confused. It's confusing. What happened to our dear state? Everybody seems distracted and upset. Everybody seems to be kind of on edge and angry. Is that a valid observation or am I just imagining?
Very valid. The left is over.
It's discernible. You come into the state from as an outsider who, in my case, used to live here when I was young, and the Matterhorn was the tallest thing for 5 miles around. And you can go to Disneyland with, and get the e-tickets. Remember the e-tickets?
Yeah.
The coveted e-tickets, you know?
Mike has a question.
Joe, could you just give a brief description how you got from entomology to involved with all this, what motivated it, and why you're so passionate about it?
Sure. Well, when I worked in the Middle East a lot as an entomologist, I deliberately sought opportunities to work in Islamic countries. And instead of spending all my per diem that I got on the Hilton or the Radisson in the enclaves, I would go and live in places like Al-Fundak Jenatain and go across the street to a Palestinian falafel guy and sit there with my guitar and sing for my supper and learn Arabic and stuff that way. And that's how I became to know the Arabic culture up close and personal. And I also study Quranic Arabic because I figure if I'm going to work in this environment, I need to be capable and competent. And I need to understand what it is, what they base their worldview on. And so that's what I did. I started studying Quranic Arabic way, way back, way, way, way back before 9/11. And as I worked in these Middle Eastern countries, I saw up close and personal what Sharia law, how it affects a culture. For example, one day I was in Sana'a in some side neighborhood, running around with somebody who was on errands, going from place to place. And while he went into one of the houses, I noticed a little girl in a pink dress with her doll sitting on the ground playing in the dirt all by herself, probably 8, 9, 10 years old. Bright pink dress, I'll never forget it. And when he came back out, before he started the car and we took off, he said, "Mr. Heaney, see that girl right there? Yes. She'll be married tomorrow." Of course, you know child marriage is legal in Islam. Because Muhammad married Aisha. Anybody remember how old she was when he married her?
Six.
But he was a gentleman. He didn't consummate the marriage till she was 9. So I saw these kind of things up close and personal. And I was an entomologist. I studied ants. And there's one side of my personality that's very linear and methodical. When I do a research, I was a research entomologist with the University of California. And I set up replicated field trials. And I was adamant about precision. You know, the mathematical, statistical analysis. I already knew I would have to analyze it statistically when I was finished, and I wanted my p-values to be up high. So I took very careful notes and detail. The thing about an entomologist, the two qualities that make a good one are observation of behavior and attention to detail. All living creatures have behavior patterns. We do, and so do everything else in the created world. By basing your observations on their behavior, you can almost always find the weak point in the biological cycle. And that's where you put the good guys, the good bugs, into the cycle. And that's what keeps you from spraying. Like strawberries, here in California, the very first crop that was used, one of the very first biological control, was mites that eat mites in strawberries. And the other crop that was well known for that was citrus. And that's the crop that I worked in. And in fact, he used to be the manager of the Fillmore Citrus Protective District, 10,000 acres of the very first cooperative that was based on biological control in the whole world. And I had a knack for it, and it sent me all over the world. But in terms of observation of behavior and close attention to detail, that's basically qualities of a good counterterrorism specialist, too. And then you superimpose over that the concept of Sharia law, which is a very, very restrictive form of law that preordains everything that people who live under that form of law can do, all the way from which foot you're supposed to put in the bathroom first. And even more intimate details than that, I won't go into now, but just whatever your imagination comes when I say the word intimate personal relationship, it's covered by Sharia law. The specter is there like a shadow overlooking everything you do from the time you're born to the time you die. So I observed the behavior of insects, in particular ants. I was an ant specialist. And I traveled all over the world. That's what gave me the key, the cachet, the passport to travel all over the world was my specialty in ants. And I noticed that they, as you will also, have a habit of walking in trails. So counterterrorism, to sum up the question, is really follow a trail and find a nest. And the reason that I got in so much trouble is this administration insists there's no nest. That these are random ants of violence, i.e. random acts of violence. But there's no such thing as a random ant of violence. There's no such thing as a random act of violence, because in the Islamic worldview, the idea of being separated from the community, from the ummah, the mother, that's the word in Arabic for community, which is the same as mother, that intimate, is horrifying. It's just inconceivable. Individuals who are in the Islamic community don't do anything on their own. They're always part of a community, and people always know what they're doing. Always. You can't escape it. So when the Imam of the San Bernardino Masjid, Darul Uloom al-Islamiyah San Bernardino, said to the American public, "I don't know him," I knew immediately that he was lying. Why? Because Sayyid Farooq was a Hafiz. Anybody know what a Hafiz is? Yeah. He had memorized the Quran, and he was certified. He could have been an imam, Sayyid Farooq, the murderer from San Bernardino. So how do you get certified as a Hafiz? You get it from the University of Phoenix with a little certificate on the wall? No, it's done through the Shura Council of the masjid that you attend, in other words, the leadership. The Imam of the Darul Uloom, which by the way means House of Knowledge, al-Islamiyah of Islam, San Bernardino, was the one that certified Sayyid Farooq as a Hafiz. And the reason why that he went to Saudi Arabia is because it was an arranged marriage. Tashfeen Malik was the daughter of a wealthy Pakistani businessman who had his businesses in Saudi Arabia. So between the imam was the liaison between him and Sayyid Farooq. Sayyid Farooq went to Saudi Arabia to marry Tashfeen Malik on Ramadan as part of an arrangement. Why? Because he was a pious young man. He showed great promise. And for that man, his daughter was going to marry a worthy person. So he could have been an imam. Anybody read the book about the madrasa boys? I can talk about that. But I watched the American citizens who were in a parallel madrasa system right here in the United States who never graduate from high school. They're taken out of fourth and fifth grade and put in a parallel madrasa system right here, and they become Hafiz, and they're qualified to go and study at a madrasa in South Africa called Zakaria Madrasa that's run by English-speaking Deobandis, Tablighi Jamaat, people from the subcontinent of India, because they speak to teach in English. So all of the English-speaking world is sending their young men to this madrasa in South Africa. It's called the Alim program. It's a seven-year program. And they become certified at their pre-qualification is they have to be a Hafiz in order to even go. So these guys are superstars. They're not ordinary. They're just like any other kid that happens to be good in baseball or some other sport. They're seen, they're selected by their father and the Shura Council. They run through this parallel system. They're sent out to this madrasa in South Africa. And I happen to be this CBP officer that saw the first generation. I caught them. And I interviewed them for 5 years. It's the madrasa boy case. And I watched them turn into naive, fuzzy-faced kids into Salafi Muslims. They knew me, and I knew them. That's the case that the government shut down. When I talk about the 67 records, anybody know what I'm referring to? When I talked on Megyn Kelly on the 10th, I mentioned the records that were deleted, that were directly related to the Darul Uloom al-Islamiyah Mosque in San Bernardino. That was the Tablighi Jamaat case. Syed Farak was a part of Tablighi Jamaat, and so was Darul Uloom. Darul Uloom al-Islamiyya San Bernardino is like a trademark, just like Burger King and McDonald's. Anywhere you go to a Darul Uloom masjid, you know what you're going to get there. And that's a worldwide network. It's also established right here in the United States. And so the problem is that when they deleted that information, they cut off the connection between the individual, or the ant, if you will, and the colony. And every time we hear the watch next time, I hope there's never another attack, but next time, even the attacks that just happened, what was the narrative?
Lone wolf,
not connected, nobody knew him, and will never understand why he did it. All false. And they know it. How do they know it? Well, for one thing, I went to Congress 50 times and told them. For one thing, Jay Johnson, my former boss, told Ted Cruz on the 30th of June, when Ted Cruz, are you aware of Mr. Haney's claims that the information was deleted out of the system? Do you know Mr. Haney? No, I wouldn't recognize Mr. Hannon if he walked into the same room. You're kidding me, right? You're the Secretary of Homeland Security. Mr. Hannon is making national security claims on national television, and you have the audacity to tell the Oversight Committee Chairman, Ted Cruz, that you don't even know him? And then he said, well, have you taken time to look into his claims? I already said I don't know him, and no, I haven't taken time to look into his claims. He doesn't even have the professional skill to say, yeah, I am. I agree with you. That's a concerning issue. We'll look right in. We'll get right onto it. We'll look into it. He didn't say that. No, I don't know him, and no, I haven't taken time to look into his claims. Well, if they were true, would you be concerned? Paraphrasing, no, not really. It's just a matter of semantics and labels. And then he ripped it off into this whole big long explanation that had nothing to do with what Ted Cruz asked him. But I'll tell you what, friends, the people in Orlando and San Bernardino and Fort Hood and Boston Marathon and all the other places are not semantics and labels. And the information that they deleted out of the system wasn't semantics and labels. It was birth dates, passport numbers, real names, places of birth, what we call biometric information. And it's the basic foundation of any law enforcement case, what we call the dots. And when Janet Napolitano said to the Homeland Security Committee after the Boston bombing that we didn't get a ping on Sarnia, remember anybody remember her saying that? Mm-hmm. I almost cussed out loud.
Yeah.
You arrogant SOB. The reason that you didn't get any pings is because you're taking the information out of the system. And you're making intelligence officers look like utter fools, like we don't know what we're doing. What an abject abrogation of constitutional authority to say, we didn't get a ping. You're telling me if a person who is a lawful permanent resident, anybody here been naturalized who was started out as an LPR? Yeah, you know what an A number is, right?
Sure.
Of course you do, because it follows you around.
Absolutely.
You live and die by the A number, don't you?
Absolutely.
Now, when you travel, you tell us, if you came back and you had your LPR card but no passport, what would be the first thing the customs officer would have asked you? Where's your passport?
Right.
You can enter back into the United States on a green card. Call lawful permanent resident. Everybody calls them green cards. They are actually green now, by the way. But you can't travel outside of the United States on a green card. You have to have the passport of the country you originated from. When Tamerlane Tsarnaev came back, he didn't have his passport. How in the heck did you get back here without your passport, by the way? That should have been right there enough to send him to secondary for more questioning, and that should have been enough to get the FBI on the phone, especially when they found out he would have been in Chechnya and Ossetia and those kind of hot spots over there. What were you doing over there, Tamerlane? Where is your passport? Oh, I lost it. No, he didn't lose it. He went over there to get a new one, but his friend from Canada came along too and got sniped right there by Russian special forces. He figured he was next. He bailed. He got out of there and came back to the United States, and he walked, we call it DTR, down the road. He walked right through, and nobody stopped him. The point about it is that when Janet Napolitano said we didn't get a ping, she makes us look like we're zombie robots that must depend on buttons that we push in some electronic system before we can recognize that there might be a terrorist standing right in front of us. That's not what DHS was created for. DHS was created to protect our country from threat of terrorism. Simple, 24-word mandate. It's in the back of the book in the appendix. Protect America from terrorism and from threats of terrorism. You don't need an electronic system to recognize a potential threat, or you shouldn't rely on it. You should be able to discern what you see right in front of you. Is there any water bottles?
Yeah. Wait.
You said Sonara got back in the country. Was it just incompetence?
Okay, how about this?
Trained to ask the right questions?
I'm going to answer your question by giving you another example. Just recently, we all heard about the mistaken granting of citizenship hundreds and hundreds.
Yeah.
They were not ordinary people from the UK or the Commonwealth or Australia. They were people, all of them were special interest countries with deportation orders or criminal background. All of them. Not ordinary people from EU countries. They were all people from places like Yemen or Pakistan or Afghanistan or Sudan or Somalia. They were all, quote unquote, mistakenly given citizenship. Is that really possible?
No.
Do you have to take fingerprints to get a driver's license?
Yeah.
What if San Diego County DMV issued 315,000 driver's licenses to people that didn't have fingerprints and then said it was a mistake?
No.
Is it really a mistake? They mistakenly give you a driver's license? No. How can it possibly be? Maybe one or two, but hundreds of thousands. By the way, that report, the IG report, talks about a team that found this lapse, and it was called the Janus team. Somebody would like to remind us who Janus was?
Gatekeeper.
He was Two-Face. Whoever was on that team was really smart, because they named the project after the fact that we can't tell who these people are. Which face are you today? And then on top of it, they lost the fingerprint records of 600,000 people. But the worst part of the report that wasn't even mentioned on the news is down in the last couple paragraphs where it says in 2016, they shut down the Janus program. They refused to refund it, which means subject matter experts that initially found this flaw, they shut the whole team down, exactly like what they did with me. In the different cases that I worked on, for example, Tablighi Jamaat case out of the National Targeting Center in Washington, D.C., when they deleted the 67 records, which led to San Bernardino shootings. These things have consequences. Oh, the water bottle. Here's an allegory. See, this one hasn't been opened yet, but there's three elements in this water bottle. I'll give you a clue. One of them is water. Okay, what are the other two things?
Air
is number two.
Plastic.
So we have two of three, not the plastic, nothing affiliated
inside
with the water or the plastic or the air. It's a third completely distinct thing that's in this water bottle.
It's full?
No.
Sodium?
Additives?
No, none of that either. Maybe if we go like that, it'll be a clue. What is light? Oh, of course it is. It's obvious when you see it, isn't it? If there was no light in this water bottle, it would be a black object. You'd see a black object like a black hole in space that I could put my hand in through. Counterterrorism is learning to recognize what is right in front of you. It doesn't announce itself, but it's there. And once you see it, since cops love donuts, I'll bet you a coffee and a donut that you're never going to look at an ordinary water bottle quite the same again, because you're going to remember this little allegory of seeing what is right in front of you. And once you see it, you never unsee it, do you? And we took our oath of office to protect our country from threat, both foreign and domestic. If you're a person of integrity and honor, there's something that you can never do once you take your vow. It's this. I cannot cover my face and pretend that I don't see it. History is a fearsome woman. She's beautifully fearsome. If she fastens her gaze on you, she will not blink. And if she finds you on the wrong side of history, she will turn you into a stone. Neville Chamberlain. Isn't that the way we think of him? Like frozen in time with that paper in his hand. Mm-hmm. History turned him into a stone. There are people in this administration who are perilously close to being turned into stones. And they will not be redeemable. Like Hillary Clinton said, they really will be irredeemable. Because once you're captured by history, you can't go back in time and change it. And I tried all the way I could, 50 times going to Congress. And the first time that I ever spoke in public was before Ted Cruz's Judiciary Committee hearings on the 28th of June. By the way, we're up to 57%. We're really making progress here.
Yeah.
Are you guys getting hypnotized by watching that little thing?
No, we're watching you.
Yeah, we're hypnotized by you.
Okay.
So this is has to do with seeing what's right in front of you. That's counterterrorism. And that's what this administration denies exists. I testified before the Senate Judiciary Committee before Ted Cruz on the 28th of June and talked about Sharia law. If any of you saw it, I made a deliberate point of holding up pictures, meaning copies of the icons of Tablighi Jamaat and the Muslim Brotherhood, and the Assembly of Muslim Jurists of America. Majama Fukaha al-Sharia bi-Amrikia. Did you guys recognize one of the words that I just said? That's the Assembly of Muslim Jurists of America. They are overtly and openly promoting implementation of Sharia law right here in the United States. You know what ALAC is? American Law for American Courts? Every time a state introduces ALAC, they get a huge political pushback from ACLU-type organizations and from CARE et al., front groups from the Muslim group, Muslim Brotherhood, insisting that they have no intention whatsoever of implementing Sharia law in the United States. Mm-hmm. It's a big, fat lie. Mm-hmm. The center of gravity of the entire Muslim community in the United States is the AMJA, because they issue fatwas to help the Muslim community in the United States navigate through the perilous obstacles of living in a non-Sharia compliant country like the United States. And most of it, they issue fatwas on concepts like whether you can be in the military or be in work for the federal or state government or in law enforcement. And what they base their fatwas on is the concept of enmity and loyalty. Basically, they say, you can join these organizations as long as you hate them in your heart. And front the whole thing. It's a huge facade. Nidal Hassan was a perfect example of that. Existential impossibility of loving two things at once, like the Bible says, serving two masters, you're going to cling to one or hold to the other, tore him apart. Because people are not made to live under that kind of pressure. And he chose the way of Sharia, and he killed those people in Fort Hood. My talk is actually about strategy and tactics. The global Islamic movement, which is not what I call them, it's what they call themselves, led primarily by the Muslim Brotherhood in the Arab-speaking world, and primarily by the Deobandi movement. Deoband is a place in northern central India that started a pro-Sharia, pro-Jihad, Salafi movement in the 1860s and then found, lo and behold, that they are ideologically exact template of the Wahhabis in Saudi Arabia. That's why Saudi Arabia supports all the madrasas in the Indian subcontinent, because they're ideologically exactly the same. The only difference is the language, Urdu and Pashtun. On the Deobandi Tablighi Jamaat branch of Salafi Islam. Salafi, by the way, does not mean radical. You've heard the term, perhaps, associated with the concept of radicalism. It doesn't mean that. It means original. Go back to the original form. Not has nothing to do with radical. And the other branch is the Arab-speaking Muslim Brotherhood. Or it looks like something's happening.
Yeah. Hit the space bar. Hit a control key.
Well, it's not done making coffee yet.
Okay.
Philip, how much of this is coming through the UN?
That's a whole other layer of the onion. Our illustrious former Secretary of State, anybody heard about the Istanbul process?
No.
That'll be my first homework assignment for you. Look up the Istanbul process. Hillary Clinton was the speaker at the inaugural meeting. It's a parallel to, anybody know about the UN Resolution 1618, criminalizing defamation of Islam on
yes.
global level?
Yes.
Well, the Istanbul process is a close companion to the UN Resolution 1618 effort. And it basically will criminalize on a global level defamation of Islam. Because
wow.
according to Sharia law, I'm a criminal right now. I could be killed, and I mean that absolutely literally, right here, right there, for saying, talking about what I'm talking about. It is illegal for a non-Muslim to refer in any way whatsoever to the Quran or to the theology of Islam. It is a high crime, a capital offense. That means if these laws are implemented and pushed through, our sovereignty and our freedom of speech will be gone. We might be able to maintain it within the borders of our own country, but Lord help you if you go outside the boundaries of the United States. Salman Rushdie on steroids. We're all managed to get up to 75%. We're making progress. Okay, I apologize for the little bit of the non-direct approach, because I'm trying to answer questions and incorporate what I may have covered in the PowerPoint at the same time. Go ahead.
I would like for you to take your knowledge, what you've already said, and talk about the election right now.
I was investigated 9 times by my own agency. 8 of them were under this administration. I have seen Hillary Clinton and the State Department and the Department of Homeland Security, Civil Rights and Civil Liberties, way up close and personal. I know exactly what they're capable. They are by no means incompetent. They are extremely capable and competent. They are malicious, vindictive, dangerous individuals who have put us at great peril. Hillary Clinton is the one that shut down the Tablighi Jamaat case that led directly, not only to San Bernardino, but also Orlando. Some of you might have heard me 2 days after the Orlando shooting talk on Breitbart, and I told the country, it's not about Omar Mateen, it's about the Islamic Center of Fort Pierce. I tied them to the entire Tablighi Jamaat network with that very same computer sitting in my RV in Pohia Park, RV Park, down south of Washington, D.C. That's how long it took me. Less than 3 hours. And that's after I double and triple checked everything. I tied them directly with 0 degrees of separation to the network that the government insists doesn't exist, and shut down and pull the information out of the system. That's the Orlando shooting. And now Rahmani from New York, very likely, because his masjid is called the Community Center of New Jersey, is very likely also tied up to this same Deobandi Salafi Tablighi Jamaat network that I've already referred to. But yet, like the Imam of the San Bernardino Mosque, his brother is the imam of the same mosque right here in San Diego that Anwar al-Awlaki was imam of. The brother of Imam of San Bernardino is the imam of a Muslim Brotherhood Front organization here in San Diego right now. What does that mean? A fusion between the large Deobande Asian Pashto Urdu speaking Salafi branch of Islam and the large Muslim Brotherhood Arabic speaking branch of Salafi Islam have merged together. And that's the danger of the narrative of pointing and saying, oh, they're not part of any foreign terrorist organization. Well, try finishing the sentence. Comma, pause for effect, as we say in law enforcement, but they are part of a network that operates right here in the United States. Except that, oops, we removed all the information from the system. And that's because they want to maintain plausible deniability and basically maintain, oh, well, we really tried as hard as we could, but there's really nothing we could do. Baloney. The people that took the vow to protect our country from threat, both foreign and domestic, are very, very capable. And to finish up and answer your question, Donald Trump is an entrepreneur. He's not going to sabotage the very system that made him successful. I would much rather take the quote-unquote uncertainty of Donald Trump than the obvious certainty of Hillary Clinton, because I already know what they will do. She has the power, the ability, to change the Benghazi narrative in real time. Mm-hmm. Let me borrow your paper. I'll give it right back. Here is, I'm David Petraeus. I just did my intelligence briefing on what happened in Benghazi. I'm talking minutes after the initial reports. He's got his top secret. He writes down his little analysis and he gives it to you. Now take it to the White House. And by the time you hand it to her, they've already changed the narrative. Mm-hmm. You think about that for a minute. They're changing history in real time.
For their own benefit? Why are they doing this?
Because if they would have told the truth about Benghazi, Obama would have lost.
Right.
Because they kept saying Al-Qaeda is on the run and GM is alive, remember? And that the ISIS was a JV team, remember?
Yeah.
The fact is, they were arming ISIS out of Benghazi.
Sure.
They were shipping weapons to the coast of Syria. And they were shipping them to three distinctly named groups. How do I know that? Because the Defense Intelligence Agency published a report in August of 2012 describing exactly what was going on in Benghazi. And Judicial Watch FOIA'd it. And we got it. Shipping weapons to small force on the coast of Syria, providing them to three groups, al-Nusra Front, al-Qaeda of Iraq, and the Muslim Brotherhood, and it specifically says Muslim Brotherhood. And when I read that, I thought, no wonder I was always in so much trouble with the administration. I was targeting the very organization that they're forming an alliance with, both in the foreign policy arena and in the domestic policy arena, vis-a-vis counterterrorism. No wonder. That's what hit me when I read that report. And the third thing is that they did is the alliance. Remember the alliance? The wanted alliance that was going to help push Assad out? They said, you guys on the ground, take eastern Syria as a buffer between Hezbollah and Iran on the east and Assad and cut them off so that they can't work together. Well, guess what? They did it. They took eastern Syria. Then what happened? They looked over their shoulder and they saw the back door of Fallujah wide open and they took it. That, my friends, is ISIS. They morphed into a Frankenstein. We created in the laboratory and he escaped.
Yeah.
He got out and now he is running rampant around Syria and Iraq. So, I would take the uncertainty of Trump, however you want to define that, any day over the certainty of Hillary Clinton. Because can you imagine what they will do if she receives a mandate from, quote unquote, from the American people? She will stomp the First Amendment into the ground. I already know because I saw it. It happened to me over and over and over again.
And the Second Amendment.
Yes. Just in the fact that she lied about Benghazi and have the ability, the audacity, the hubris, what I call obscene hubris, to change history in real time, or at least attempt to, by sending Susan Rice out, who said exactly the same thing like the parrot, five times on that first Sunday. They knew then it was a lie. And they're still to this very day maintaining the facade of the whole thing. Obama would have lost if they would have simply been honest and said, no, Al-Qaeda is not on the run. In fact, they're about to take Iraq. And it's because we provided them the weapons. I'll give you a second homework assignment. Go on Google, and Google the pictures of the guys when they took Fallujah. You'll see them carrying black banners with ski masks on. Look at their gear. Look at their feet, shoes. U.S. issue.
Nike.
Yeah. The reason why they wore those masks is because they knew that we knew who they were. So they cover their faces and march down the street of Fallujah with the big black jihad flag with U.S. issue gear.
They were American cars that they drove, too.
So, I hope that was the answer to your question.
But just to tack on is, can you talk about Uma Abedin?
Yes. Uma Abedin's parents are part of the World Muslim League, which is a Sharia-promoting organization financed by Saudi Arabia, but also intricately linked into Muslim Brotherhood. That's her parents, her father and her mother. She, when she was in school, was with the Muslim Students Association, which is the very first Muslim Brotherhood organization founded in Indiana in about 1963. After Nasser pushed out the Muslim Brotherhood, purged them out, they scattered all over the world, and some of them came here. And they started all over again in setting up the network. And that first organization was the Muslim Students Association, which now has branches in virtually every campus in the United States. And their firstborn child, so to speak, was Islamic Society of North America, which is now the largest public Muslim Brotherhood front group operating in the United States. They were proven irrefutably in federal court in November of 2008 in the Dallas Holy Land Foundation trial to be linked to Hamas, a globally designated terrorist organization, which means what? If the Department of Justice proved irrefutably in November 2008, exactly the same month when the elections took place, what does that say? They know. The choices that they made were deliberate and intentional, which means they put all of us in peril, deliberately and intentionally. And those people were brought into the administration gradually over time. And another reason why I collided headlong with my own administration is because I targeted the leaders of every single one of those organizations and the organizations themselves and put it into our system called TECS, T-E-C-S. A law enforcement database. I call it an archive database because anybody at any given time can access it and we can talk to each other in real time. Then President Obama gave his A New Beginning speech in Cairo on June 4th, 2009, and told the Islamic world that we're not going to base our relationship with you on law enforcement counterterrorism, we're going to base it on civil rights and civil liberties. They took the 508 or the 805 and went off in a different direction and left people like myself completely open and vulnerable because they had a decision at that point to make. The first level of their reaction was to ignore the information that was already in the database. Ignore. Passive. Just pretend like it's not there. But that didn't work because the records that we put in the system were actually functioning as they were meant to. And people that were in the administration were being brought into secondary for questioning. Where did you go? We call it the five W's. Who, what, where, when, and why. Well, of course, they got on the phone and called their contacts in the executive branch. And as we say in the South, pitched a fit. And they were backed up by the executive branch of the government. And they came after people like myself and told us to take the information out. It won't do. They had people that were bringing into the administration being sent to secondary. and having themselves insulted and their civil rights and civil liberties violated. But that's only the first level. That's passive. The next level is to remove the information out of the system. Let's just be done with this irritating, derogatory information and remove it. And that's what they started to do in 2009 when they ordered me through DHS headquarters to delete all the linking information out of 820-something records in the tech system, all related to the Muslim Brotherhood Network. This is way before what I told you about Tablighi Jamaat. That happened in 2012. This happened in 2009. Exactly 1 year after the Holy Land trial. That means that's what I call obscene hubris. They knew that all these organizations were tied irrefutably to Hamas, and rather than respond to it, that was a departure point, friend. If you want to know when our country started going off the road, it was November of 2008. And then a year later when they said, we're going to delete all the information. But even that wasn't enough. They went to the third level. They started coming after the subject matter experts that knew this information and had put that stuff into the system in the first place. And just like the top of a pyramid, they went after the top people first, and they knocked us off one at a time. I was the first to get hit, but I was the last to remain standing. I was investigated 9 times. When my career was over, they took my gun. Anybody here in law enforcement or military? To be stripped of your gun is like being stripped naked in public. What did Mr. Haney do now? He must have really screwed up this time. It's an open humiliation. 1 second. Then they cut off all access to the system that I've been using my whole career. Then they revoked my secret clearance and had the audacity to say it's not an adverse action. And then they sequestered me in a little room with no assigned job duties for the last 11 months of my career while I was under 3 simultaneous investigations. Internal Affairs, Customs and Border Protection, with 2 top-level investigators, Inspector General of Department of Homeland Security, and Office of Integrity, Department of Justice, and they convened a grand jury to indict me on criminal charges. But they had to find probable cause first. And I waited for the proverbial knock on the door, or, Mr. Haney, we have some questions we'd like to ask you. Or the memo, or the letter, or the something. But it actually all culminated remarkably, as you can read in the book. I ended up retiring honorably, July 31st, 2015. The DOJ case was dropped for lack of evidence. And the administrative attacks under IG and DH and CBP led to nothing. But it was the whole point was to discredit me. So I wouldn't be standing here and talking in front of you. Because if I would have violated subsection A.37-2, I'm just making that up. But anything that they could have thrown against the wall, one little dab of mud would have stuck on that wall over there. Everybody's attention would have been focused on that little dab of mud. And there would have been enough of a residual doubt in your mind that you would not have come and listened to me talk. Because I can guarantee you the government would have made double darn sure that the word got out that I was unreliable and you shouldn't listen to me. But it didn't work. And now it's too late. The fearsome eye of history is fastened on this whole situation.
Well, not yet.
Oh, we're getting there.
They say 100, that means another 5 minutes.
Chuck Norris is coming out. And the thing about the book is, it's not about me. You'll read it. I'm in it, but it's not about me. It's about America. I'm taking a handheld camera and walking you through 15 years of history from the time of 9/11 up until the 2nd of December 2015 with the San Bernardino attack. And the thing about the book is it's an open indictment. It's a live story. And nothing in the book has been resolved yet. I also call it the black box of the crash. Beep, beep, beep. It's just sitting there beeping. One of these days, somebody's going to actually walk over and say, hey, what's that? And you're going to analyze what's in the black box with actual honesty, and you'll discover how it was this plane actually crashed.
Wow.
What do you think about Snowden?
Snowden? Well,
it's a bad movie.
Snowden. I'm not a Snowden. I did not want to be characterized as a Snowden. That's why I went to Congress 50 times. When I talked to different groups in Congress, sometimes several of them would meet together. It's like a room like this. I'd have three or four senators and several House members. And one day I said to them all, thank you so much. That I've learned one thing about this whole process. And I just stood there for a minute. What, Mr. Haney, did you learn about the whole process? That there is no process. There's no room 347 that you go and knock on the door and make an appointment and fill out a few handy forms and they say, come back next week. Boy, when you're a whistleblower, by the way, I'm not a self-designated whistleblower. Congress called me that. You're on your own, kid. And there's 100 different ways you can crash into the wall. And nobody will be there to pick you up because in most cases they hope you crash. In fact, in most cases they're bumping you and bonking you to make you crash. It's like walking across a tightrope with no net and somebody's over there on the other end shaking the thing, trying to make you fall off. These people are merciless. Yeah. Going back to your question. Yes, sir?
In the course of your activities, do you have any contact with or relationship with, Robert Spencer has written a lot about this over the years, and Horowitz Freedom Foundation, and Seth Leibson, and the other name escapes me right now, wrote a book called The Fight of Our Lives, all trying to bring out that these things are really happening.
They're part of
I don't know if anybody pays attention. A lot of people just are totally unaware of what's going on.
I hear that everywhere I go. The thing is there's people that are listening everywhere I go. And all those people are my friends. We're all part of what you are. We all are part of what I call the Alliance. I don't refer to the Republicans and the Democrats. I call them our adversaries, and we're part of the Alliance. And I'm not as nearly concerned about the candidate, whether he has an R after his name. What I base my worldview on is whether or not they're going to stand up for the principles of the Constitution. And that should make it real easy to decide who to vote for. Who is more likely to stand on the principles of the Constitution based on what we've already seen? Which candidate is more likely? Hillary Clinton's been sailing around this great storm out there in the Pacific, trying to avoid it. Problem is, if you do that too long, you will run aground. Look at that. Now it's got to do some more stuff. See, it's spinning yet.
So what's the motivation behind this? Do we truly have the Manchurian candidate who's been in office for the last 7.5 years?
Yes.
I'll read from the Constitution and I'll...
Is it possible to learn the air condition?
Yeah, it's cold.
I'm
not
yours today.
Thank you.
That's really warm.
Yeah, you're smart.
Would
it
be warmer
at the door? Yeah, let in some of the warm air.
If they're controlling the room, I don't
know.
The answer to your question, what's the motivation?
Yeah.
Power.
That is also a question that's asked every single time. And initially I didn't have what I call a snappy answer. But I came up with one because I was reading one day out of the Declaration of Independence, which I tend to do, and I came across this paragraph that whenever any form of government becomes destructive of these ends, meaning life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness, it is the right of the people, capitalized by the way, to alter or abolish it and institute new government, laying its foundation on such principles and organizing its powers in such forms as to them shall seem most likely to affect our safety and happiness. It all sounds very nice. Mm-hmm. But there's a phrase in there that answers your question. What is the goal of our adversaries? To alter or abolish this form of government. That's what they're seeking to do.
Mm-hmm.
We look at it from a benign perspective, as though this was designed to instruct us on how to meet challenges that face our culture and our society based on the principles of the founding documents. The checks and balances form of government is designed for us to address the challenges within the structure of this Constitution. But our adversaries are seeking to either alter or completely abolish it. Islam seeks to abolish it. Why? Because it opposes. Is that an active or a passive verb? Oppose.
Active.
Opposes any form of man-made government. So by definition, Sharia law seeks to overthrow the U.S. Constitution. Thus, if you're seeking to alter or abolish the structure of a society, you find a natural ally. But as we know of the Marxist-Leninist progressive left, how long have they existed in the terms that we think of them now? Since about 1917, 100 years. How long has Islam existed? So who has a tactical advantage in this thing? Islam, way over the Reds.
But Saul Alinsky didn't help things much, did he?
No.
Have you worked with Stephen Coughlin or had contact with him?
I know all of them, and they're all my friends.
Yeah.
Some of us have met him. Yes.
You ask any of them, and they will tell you. We've been pals. We're battlefield brothers.
Can you explain why it was all of a sudden? I mean, when Bill Clinton was in office, it didn't seem like there was any of this push to destroy America.
It all started.
Yeah. But then Obama comes in, and is it because he himself wants Islam to run America? And if so, then why would the rest of the Democratic Party and all of your bosses go along with him?
Because they see it as their mandate to alter or abolish this for a current form of government. It's actually deceptively simple. That's their strategy. Now let's make a distinction between strategy and tactics. Their strategy is to alter or abolish. How they go about it is the tactics of it. We have an intruder.
But he's an ally.
But 9/11 was this supposed rogue people as well.
9/11 was a tactic. What's the strategy? We've talked about it some already. What is the strategy of the global Islamic movement? Sharia law. It's, again, paradoxically, counterintuitively simple. That's their strategy. What is complicated and kaleidoscopic about it is the tactics, how they go about doing it. All of the Hezbollahs and Lashkar-e-Taiba and Tablighi-Jamaats and Boko Harams and Hamases in the world have the same exact strategy, and they don't argue about that one bit. But what they do differ in is their tactics, how they go about doing it. For example, today, when we're all finished here, what will your strategy be? Go home. See, it's so obvious that it's obvious. But what is complicated about it is if we were here for a month and everybody's sitting in exactly the same chair as they are, and we all left when those doors opened at whatever, let's just say 11:00, none of us would ever arrive home at the same time in any of those days in the month. Why? Because of all the intervening circumstances that happen. And that's tactical. How you get home is tactics, but your strategy never changes. It's simple. Must go home. That's it. Every single day. But what's complicated and kaleidoscopic is the tactics. It's the same way with the global Islamic movement, jihad, violent extremism, terror, all 29,300 and something terrorist attacks since 9/11, one every 4 hours, are all tactical. For what purpose? Sharia. That's what I've been trying to do in the last few months, is shift the discussion, and I think it's worked, away from a tactical discussion about jihad to a strategic discussion about Sharia. And this will be your third homework assignment. start noticing that people don't talk about jihad anymore as much as they do Sharia. So it's been working. What?
Well, you said that the whole story changed in November 2008. Mm-hmm. November 2008 was still when President Bush was president, probably after the election in 2008 when we knew that Obama was coming to power. What happened in November 2008 that the change was still under Bush? Why did this start happening under the Republican government? And I also have a lot of questions about the Bushes with regard to the Saudi government, because after 2011, the Saudis were given an open door to leave while no one else was, no other planes were allowed to get into the air. So I'm also interested to know where the Bush came into this picture.
That's a whole discussion in itself. Our dysfunctional relationship with Saudi Arabia, the 28 pages that we heard so much about 2 or 3 months ago, the fact that Obama has either already done it or threatened or did veto the bill in Congress that would allow American citizens to sue Saudis, all those kind of things. And what we really need to do is dispense with the ceremony and become energy independent, and then a lot of that stuff would disappear.
Phil?
Yes?
It's been an hour and 10 minutes. How long will this take? And then I have a question. Most people in this room have been listening to all this for more than a decade, and we rehash over and over again all the reasons we should be upset. I don't hear any direction or solutions, and I think it's important to get the information out, but I know very, very few people who say, this is what we do to make things better. So maybe you don't have an answer. So that's my question, and then can you run through this in about 20 minutes, because I think going on, unless everybody wants to stay for an extra hour.
Oh, yeah.
Well, do we have the room? Let me just tell you something. I know we are losing the room for sure at noon, and I'm not sure, it could be a little bit before noon if they insist on coming to prepare for their next 12 to 7. Somebody's going to be in here.
So let's go 20 minutes. It's time to clean up the signposts.
Right. Okay. Let's
stay here until we get kicked out.
Yeah, that's okay. But
well,
we need to maybe, we might be, yeah, we might, okay. We can meet out.
We could go 40 minutes and half an hour to clear out.
Okay.
I have a limited memory card, so we'll all have to remember after a few minutes.
Okay. This is like a buffet. It doesn't matter how hungry you are. You can only eat so much at once. And I recognize that.
Yes.
And I had to wing it today because I didn't have my trusty PowerPoint. So we'll go through this real quick. It didn't start in 9/11. I think we all know that. The global Islamic movement didn't spring up out of the ground like mushrooms on September 11th. The implementation of Sharia law is based on Quran 2, 191 through 193. That the deen, which means law, it's the same word in Hebrew, deen, judge, or religion, shall yakatum, shall prevail be all for art in the earth. That's the strategy. That's why I made the point about what's the strategy of everybody going home, to go home today. Very simple. Islam or Sharia will prevail. That's the global strategy. What's complex about it are the tactics. And there's a whole array of operative verbs in the Quran. Jihad is only one of them. But jihad occurs 40 times in the Quran. There are other operative verbs called betel, which means slaughter, and karaj, which means violently dispossessed, that occur 4 times more frequently in the Quran than jihad. 4 times more. And their dimensions more violent. They're obscenely violent. And they are what I call operative verbs, and there's a catalyst. They have to have a catalyst to be enacted. And that catalyst is called fitna, which means opposition to the advancement of Islam. So the whole West is a fitna to the global Islamic community. We are seen as deliberately and intentionally standing in the way of the mandate from Allah to implement Sharia law. And therefore, those operative verbs are kicked into action. They're catalyzed. Does that make sense?
Yes.
That's the difference between strategy and tactics. What's the motive? We already went through this, alter or abolish. Who's seeking to... We talked about opposing Islam, opposing the U.S. Constitution. This here, by the way, I'm going to give you the PowerPoint and you can send it out to everyone. Always make it available.
Oh, thank you.
So you don't have to dig through all this stuff or try to remember everything. It's all there, and all the sources and links are all there, so you don't have to... It's user-friendly. You can. This point here, see this little phrase down here? Observant Muslim base, or base of observant Muslims. In Arabic, it is in the middle. Al-Qaeda al-Muslimina al-Mutsima. The observant Muslim base. Did you hear a word in there that sounds kind of familiar? Al-Qaeda. Al-Qaeda is not an organization. It's a concept. The point of the Muslim Brotherhood operating in the United States, this was authorized by the Shura Council in North America in 1987, is to create a conformed, observant, obedient Muslim base across the country that will push forward the strategy of what?
Sharia
law. Now we're getting somewhere. It simplifies everything. I didn't say you like it or you agree with it, but once you see it from their perspective of what their goal is, it clarifies everything. Ominously, yes, but nonetheless, it does simplify it. That word at the top is simply Al-Qaeda, and that's where it is in Arabic. This is the explanatory memorandum, the Muslim Brotherhood strategic and tactical document that was written by Muhammad Akram Adouni, who used to be an LPR right here. Now he's raising money for Hamas in Europe and the Far East. He's still alive. And this talks about civilization jihad, which is the same as settlement jihad. Did you know that people who are muhajirun, who immigrate, receive the same reward in heaven as the mujahideen? Mm-hmm. That's good. That's from Quran 860. That means when people immigrate, it's deliberately and intentionally, with an expectation of reward. Not to come and learn to like hot dogs and apple pie. There's another reason for it. It's for the promotion of Sharia law, and the reason why the Muslim Brotherhood and other leftist groups are trying to bring these people in, from their perspective, is to build an observant Muslim base. It all actually makes a lot of sense. And this administration is aiding and abetting in it. We're seeing it happen right in front of us.
Why?
We don't know who these people are. Remember Janus, Two-Face? Why?
Why the left?
I think they're unknown puppets. Is that correct?
Institute totalitarianism.
This merges from the realm of visible and rational into the realm of invisible and abstract. And there's a point with the elected officials and the form of government that we are actually part of where it merges into the invisible level, that mystery, if you will, of what really motivates the hearts and minds of people. And we're seeing this in our own country. The irony is that as Americans, we pretty much thought we were immune from this, but we're not immune to it.
But why would someone like Hillary Clinton want Sharia law effectively to replace our system of law? That would take away all her power. Under Sharia law, women have no rights. She would not be able to leave the country. Her daughter would not be able to walk around in public. I don't understand.
Lord of the Rings.
What does that mean?
The ring.
Power.
The evil of it.
It's a means to
an end. It transformed Gollum into a monster, and yet he was so enamored with it that even though it destroyed him. And these people don't realize that their ideology is destructive, and it does destroy them.
She knows what Sharia law is.
She does.
She knows what
she's actively promoting.
She thinks she's above it. She thinks it'll happen to us, but not her.
It's human nature.
It's also part of their strategy from the progressive left to alter or abolish, to change, to improve, to eliminate bias, discrimination, one of the other things, make it more inclusive and diverse. Yes. Okay, we're going to keep moving simply because this is the icon of the Muslim Brotherhood. You've all seen that before.
Yeah.
But you may or may not have known what this word right here is. Wa'aidu. It means prepare. It's from Quran 860. Prepare to do what?
Sharia. Jihad.
Prepare to slaughter your enemies and terrify them. That's what it says. Quran 860. Allah fall, the spoils of war, is the most violent chapter in the entire Quran. You think it's an accident that the Muslim Brotherhood took that word out of Quran 860? The point is, why did the administration form an alliance with that organization?
Yes.
And bring them into the domestic counterterrorism arena and the foreign policy arena?
Why?
Is there anything moderate about that at all? No, because they see them as natural allies.
Yeah.
And, but they're being deceived themselves because, as I talked to you about the tactical advantage, the more chaotic a culture comes, the better it is for them.
Mm-hmm.
But we're distracted.
Mm-hmm.
It's just like this, you know, you're looking at me. Now I've got your notebook. How'd I manage to get it? Because he's sitting over there, or he wasn't protecting it. Now I have it. Except I violated a tenet of Islam. I was supposed to notify you first. Dawah offer you to join me. So I will tell you, my goal now is to acquire that notebook from you. You can either join me or I will take it. See, that's the right response. But now you just committed a crime, according to Sharia law.
Mm-hmm.
Now you are my overt adversary, and I can use those operative verbs and knock you right off your chair.
You can try.
Yeah. What is the, and how is, what are we protected by? This.
And this.
That's right. Wisdom. And these people are not invincible. To answer your question, part of what we need to do is become more familiar with what these terms are and what these concepts are, because it will change your worldview for the better. I mean, I didn't say you'd have to like it, but at least you'll understand it. And that gives you power and strength to stand up on the principles that this country was founded for, which is what it's all about, right? We're
Amen.
Conservatives, right?
Amen.
What are we trying to conserve?
Constitution.
Exactly. And what are our adversaries trying to do?
Alter
or abolish it. So this, by the way, the reason why I brought it up is because there's my former boss right there. Remember when he said he didn't know me and he hadn't looked into my claims? Well, he sure enough proved it about a month later. He went to the ISNA 53rd Annual Convention and spoke before them. And if you all had clearances, I could tell you derogatory information about every single one of these people on this picture. And he stands right there. That's what I call, again, obscene hubris. How can you imagine working for a person like that when you targeted those very same people that he insists on going and standing before and talking? He's the Secretary of Homeland Security. The Muslim Brotherhood is a malevolently adversarial organization, and he stands before them. There's a problem there. That's why I will not quit, because I took a vow. By the way, how many people here have taken that vow at some point in their life? If you have, then do you feel like that vow is retired, it's no longer valid? If you were called upon, you would stand up for it, wouldn't you?
I would hope so.
Sure you would.
But I wonder if most of the people taking that vow, when they take it, actually believe it or intend to...
Well, we're not taught to believe it. We're not schooled in it. And I think a lot of them do take it without really comprehending the depth of what it really may involve, which includes your life and sacred honor. They're not really taught that. And President Obama spoke at the same meeting last year. Why does it matter about ISNA? It's a co-conspirator in the Holy Land trial. Known ties to Hamas. This is the level that we're at. These people are colluding in our own demise, collaborating in our demise, as Bot York said. It's important because these groups are still designated as co-conspirators in the Holy Land trial. Who else? Diversity. This is what I call parachuting immigrants into small communities across the country. I've been traveling all over the country speaking with these in small places. It seems my niche has become the small towns of America, that the grassroots level that none of the big organizations in D.C., even the good guys, quite managed to reach, because we're out there in the heart of America. And so that's what I've been doing, is meandering around the country speaking with little groups like Grand Rapids, Minnesota, and Rutland, Vermont, and Sioux Falls, Iowa, and places like that. And here is the thing, the report I mentioned to you about the mistaken granted citizenship to the people that didn't have any fingerprints, that were from special interest countries. So, again, get the PowerPoint because the links to all this is in there, and you can go read it all yourself. Sharia law, this is just a screenshot of the hearings. And Farhan Akira is the one over here. And she's the one that said there are no radical imams in America.
Who invited you to speak after you get the court to come?
Senator Cruz.
Yeah.
A lot of this stuff happened behind the scenes. I know those 50 times that I went to Congress beforehand. I don't mean to sound pompous, but the whole hearing was set up on whether I would speak in public or not. And I said, of course I will. And so they set it up. They spun it up and they got it going. And I commend him for it.
Yeah.
They called it willful blindness. Anyway, Farhana said she didn't know any. I called John Zadrozny the next day and I said, you trapped her, you realize? I said, what do you mean, Mr. Haney? If she doesn't believe there's any radical imams in the United States, then she's endorsing the subversion of the Constitution because they're promoting Sharia law. So that, therefore, she doesn't believe that Sharia is radical.
It's not radical, it's regular.
That's right. For example, is there a moderate version of the U.S. Constitution and a radical version of the U.S. Constitution?
I know.
No, it doesn't. It seems silly when you put it in. So there's no radical and moderate form of Sharia law either. There is Sharia law, which, by the way, is actually a book. It's not abstract. It's a book. And you can use that as a bulldozer to destroy the arguments of your opposition. It is a book. It's not abstract. You don't have to quibble about subtle meanings. It's an actual book. And this is when DHS Secretary Johnson said he had no idea if officials were scrubbing radical Islam from documents. Well, why don't you just call me up? I'll tell you. This is part of his hubris. This goes all the way back to 2009 when I told you about scrub. They made me scrub the information out of the system. He said he doesn't know. Okay, and then here's the real good one. Just about a week or so ago, James Clapper said that it's climate change.
Yeah.
Not Sharia, at least it's jihad. And then he realized something. Mohammed was the first environmentalist. Ecology now. Right? Wait till those Californians catch on to its recycling. No. Okay, I'm going to finish with this. We already talked about the AMJA. And remember what I told you its name was in Arabic? Majama Fukaha al-Sharia, the Amrikia. And that's just, that thing down at the bottom is just a grab off their website. It's still, you know, it's that organization's still in operation. Call your congressman and ask them why the AMJA is still operating. Why is it allowed? It's overtly seeking to overthrow the U.S. Constitution. According to Article 6, we all know Article 6, right? Article 6 of the Constitution says, this isn't even a First Amendment issue. This Constitution and the laws of the United States which shall be made in pursuance thereof and all treaties which shall be made under the authority of the U.S. shall be the supreme law of the land. It's not First Amendment. It's Article 6. Let's see what else we can do. Here's what we can do. Part law answer to your question. Also look on the back of my little card. I have four little easy steps that you can follow. Easy, like baby steps. But you'd be surprised when you take those four little baby steps where it might very well lead you. Start somewhere. Start with what you can see right in front of you, and you go from there. House Resolution 3892, the Muslim Brotherhood Designation Bill, designating them as a terrorist organization. It's a mirror bill. It has its companion in the Senate, exactly the same language. Is on the floor waiting to be read. It could actually be passed before the election, I mean theoretically. If we were to pass that, that means we're addressing an obvious threat that we're looking right out in front of us, right? And it would send a signal through the, excuse me, Salafi pro-Sharia, pro-jihad Islamic world that America is once again serious about defending its borders, and we could do it without firing a single shot or dropping a single bomb. Why don't we start with that? Let's walk softly and carry a big stick. then let's go to the next level and address the border. But even if we built a 90-foot thick wall right down here about 10 or 20 miles below us, it won't keep us safe if the doorkeepers have their hands tied. Just like how, does anybody remember how the Medo-Persians took Babylon? The Babylonian Empire fell in a night because they waited till the tide and they went under the gates of the famous walls of Babylon and took the city without hardly a single shot by coming underneath the wall.
Nebuchadnezzar.
Yeah, and it was the Medo-Persian Empire. Daniel was the prime minister of both. He was a man of such integrity. Imagine this. That when the Babylonian Empire fell, they retained him. It's like unheard of. An entire empire comes in and they kept, you, sir, you're going to keep stay with us. You're a man of integrity. It's amazing. So that's one thing you can do. The little steps on the back of the book. Become more aware, because knowledge says wisdom pulls down strong towers. These towers that we see looming out there on the horizon, which, by the way, are called Rabat. The capital of Morocco is called Rabat. It means stronghold. The minarets of a masjid are Rabat. They're signals to the entire Islamic world. Both defensive and offensive strongholds. Places of, remember, have you heard about the case of the imam giving money to the American citizen convert to buy grenades and guns? Just came out in the last couple days. Right on the checks he wrote, zakat, charity. Because 1/8 of all zakat, all charity raised within the Islamic community is obligated to go to jihad. Did you know that? Mm-hmm. So that every single time you hear Sharia-compliant finance, you know that it's supporting jihad. Because, according to Sharia, if you're compliant, 1/8, 12.5% is obligated to support the Mujahideen. That's why we can never allow Sharia law. That's just one of the subtleties. So I hope those are a couple new little tidbits that we can help us all start. Again, it's on the back of my card, 4 little steps. And I mentioned my book, but it's not just my book, any book. Just start somewhere. And let's all, I don't mean to actually do it, but let's, in your mind, think about taking the vow of a citizen. This is a government of, for, and by the people. When you're a cop, when you turn the handle of your front door and your little toe goes out that threshold, you are now on active duty. Let's all have that mentality and hope that in November we will all become so busy that we'll, as I said earlier, have to hire somebody to breathe for us, because we'll just forget to breathe. And I'd like to close with my quote, favorite quote from Abraham Lincoln, second address to Congress. 1862, the dogmas of the quiet past are inadequate for the stormy present. The occasion is piled high with difficulties, but we must rise with the occasion. As our case is new, so let us act anew and think anew. We must disenthrall ourselves, and then we shall save our country, the last best hope on earth. Thank you. Good on time and all that?
Yeah. First, let me just say that, I mean, your words really bring tears to my eyes because of what I believe in my lifetime, which is real, really, it has occurred in this country. And I know it started long before I was born, but nevertheless, it's a man like you that's working for us in the bureaucracy that we owe so much to and we would normally not even know existed except for what's happened to you because they turned against you, our own government turned against you, is such a treasure and a blessing to us Americans that I am so ashamed of what we've elected, and I didn't try to elect all these people, but what has happened. And I would say this, when I hear you, the only thing that I think could have stopped what happened to you would have been impeachment. And that, unfortunately, is not what happened, because I don't know that Congress had the power to stop it any other way, and that was, to me, probably the only way, impeaching some of these people.
You remember when Eric Holder talking before the House committee about Fast and Furious?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And they held him in contempt. Do you remember what he did, essentially?
Yeah.
Come and get me. I'll just claim executive privilege. And that was a moment of truth, my friends, right there. Because Congress realized at that minute, see, what we need to do is reinstitute tarring and feathering. Snatch that guy up by the tie like Dirty Harry. Come here, punk. And parade him down Pennsylvania Avenue. A couple of lessons like that would put a lot of this stuff to a halt.
Four immunity agreements just went out on Friday at 5.
Yeah. And yet they're still going to let her off. So what are they gaining from giving them immunity?
Right.
The whole thing is one big stinking fiasco charade.
Now,
and yet they spent all 10 years investigating people like myself and Stephen Coughlin and John Guandolo and Matthew Dooley and William Gothrop, one or two of us in each one of the major law enforcement agencies, and they expended all their effort on knocking people like us off. I told you about the revocation of my secret clearance, right?
Yes.
That was dated June 8th, 2015. Ironically enough, exactly to the day, June 8th, 2012, that I was given credit by the National Targeting Center for finding 300 terrorists. What happened between June 8th, 2012 and June 8th, 2015? Where I'm commended for finding 300 terrorists. How many were there in Fort Hood, by the way? One. How about Orlando?
One.
How about San Bernardino?
Two.
Three. Yeah.
Three.
And Ricky Marquez. See how good they are? Don't take it wrong.
Mm-hmm.
They confuse the narrative so much that we don't even realize there was a third person involved. He's in jail right now. You know why? I mean, he should be. You know why Enrique Marquez is in jail? Multiple failed plots with Syed Arif. What does that tell you?
No lone wolf there.
They knew him. They didn't stop him. Multiple failed plots with Syed Farouk? Wait a minute, I thought Syed Farouk was radicalized by this mysterious Tashfi Malik from Saudi Arabia. No. He was already involved in jihad before he ever went and met her and married her with Enrique Marquez, who he brought to Islam through what group? The FBI's unredacted transcript says Tablighi Jamaat. And that proved my point when I said it on Megan. A week later, they released their transcript, and there it was. I've never seen the FBI do it prior or since to release an unredacted transcript of the affidavit of their interview with Enrique Marquez. And in paragraph 23, it says, Syed Farouk talked to Enrique Marquez about Tablighi Jamaat. You should have heard the shockwave that went through the intelligence community in Washington. Holy smokes, Amy, how did you know? Well, I knew it because it was my case, the one that the government shut down. What if I had been wrong? I went way out on the limb when I spoke in national television, contradicted the entire administration, talking about a group that most people never heard of in their life. What if I had said he was part of Hamas, or you name it? He would have still been a terrorist, but I would have been wrong on a technicality, and I would have been discredited right there. It would have been over. See, we told you Haney is unreliable, he doesn't know what he's talking about. But when FBI, it's almost like they gave me a gift. Here, Haney, here's one for you. It was Tablighi Jamaat.
But that's not my question. That was my introduction. I apologize. My question to you is, I was not impressed with the foundation, not the foundation, but the original thinking about the Department of Homeland Security. I felt that the problems that were that could have been addressed in a different way, increasing communication between different organizations. As a matter of fact, when you tell me what Homeland Security was, these three organizations, and it wasn't FBI and CIA, I'm thinking, I thought that the problem was that the FBI and CIA weren't talking to each other. But in any case, could you speak a little bit about that? I don't like these centralized, top-down structures that demand everybody else go according to them.
Well, you're absolutely right, because FBI does not have reciprocity with DHS. And FBI interviewed Syed Farooq, Omar Mateen, and Rahmani, all three of them, we know that. And so did CBP, because all of them traveled internationally. CBP interviewed them, did not tell FBI what they learned. FBI interviewed them, did not notify DHS what they learned. And that created what I call a man-sized gap, and people are walking right through it. And we've seen the consequences of that. There's no FBI can't even access the system that we use. We have a JTTF liaison.
So nothing was solved by DHS?
No. Because, and that would be another thing to ask for Congress, what about the fact that FBI doesn't have reciprocity with DHS? I saw it over and over again. I had FBI guys come in and sit in my interviews many times.
Because they wanted the information?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. But most of the time we called them, they didn't show up. I called the FBI 3 days ago because I found my friend in Florida is on the list of ISIS kill list. They called him after months of knowing about it. And I said, ask him, call him back and ask him if you can give him, me, his phone number. So he did. 5 minutes later, he said, it's cool, call him. I did. He said, I'm sorry, Mr. Haney, I can't tell you if you're on the list because I don't have the names that are in my own jurisdiction. And that, my friends, is the problem in a nutshell. They chop these things up so that nobody knows what no left hand knows what the right hand is doing. Why didn't they form a task force and announce on public television, everybody on the list, we're going to stand behind you. You call us if you need anything. Everybody on the list, work together, because if I know him, don't you think maybe I might be collateral damage if I'm not on the list? Don't you think we all should know who's on that list and who's a target? Wouldn't that be more effective? How come we don't hear anything like that from the administration? That just shows you in a nutshell. Oh, I can't tell you because I only have this little bit of the list. Oh, I think it's online. Well, thanks. Why don't you take some initiative, sir, and look it up online yourself? And then call me back and tell me, yeah, Mr. Haney, you're on the list too. What can we do to help you? Nothing. Nothing like that whatsoever.
Yeah. Is the FBI internally conflicted? Because here, the head of the FBI told all the information he found out regarding Hillary, but then said don't pursue it.
I was worried about Comey for a long time.
Yeah.
Because I'm a cop too. And I told a lot of my friends, I'm worried about Comey.
Yeah.
Why? Because I'm not sure if he realizes he's about to face the greatest test of his integrity for his entire career. If I was his friend, I'd go over to his house and have a beer, and I'd say to him, hey, man, what's going on? What's happening? What are you thinking? I was worried about him, and I turned out, unfortunately, to be right, because if he would have done the right thing, he wouldn't have said, no reasonable judge would refuse to take the case. All he would have done is say, here, DOJ, take it.
Yeah.
And let them be the one that decided whether it was valid or not.
Right.
He didn't have the mandate to decide that they wouldn't take it. Just give it to them. And the tragedy of it is he's discredited himself.
Mm-hmm. Why?
He could
so why
have done the right thing and, quote unquote, be fired the next day.
Right.
And gone to work for any Fortune 500 company in the face of the earth, simply because they recognized that he had integrity, but he didn't do it. And now what is he going to gain from it? He can't gain anything publicly, because then it'll become obvious. So he's discredited, he's made a big, bad mistake.
But in a way, in a strange way, I agree with you 100%, let me say that first, but in a strange way, by not doing that, because if he had done that, all the evidence would become silent because there was a criminal case underway. But this way, at least, he could come out and say, she said this, we found that. She said this, we found that. It became very clear that Hillary Clinton was lying about a lot of things. The other way, if they would have taken it up for prosecution, all this information would have been silent and only would have come out if there was a trial.
Well, I also agree with you, except for one caveat. When you are in a position where you have to make a choice about what is right, you don't base your choice and your response on what the possible consequences might be. You just do what you know is the right thing. And not
I agree with you. That's why I said 100%, yeah. But I'm saying the other side of the coin is that it's fortunate that we got this information.
Can something good come out of it? Yeah. But nonetheless, he has self-inflicted, shot himself in the foot in the process.
What sort of pressures are coming down on these people to have them do their actions in such a way? Unless, the thought came to mind because you used the story earlier about the Babylon's being taken over. And if I'm not mistaken, there was a, perhaps it's biblical, talk about the handwriting on the wall. Now, do you think these people believe on some level, either knowingly or unknowingly, that there is a handwriting on the wall, and it's inevitable, it's going to happen, and it's going along to get along, and perhaps as they may not be out of the equation, Hillary or any number of people will be absolved as a result of going along. But what sort of pressures must there be on these people?
Well, I can tell you.
Was he protecting his job?
Well, that's the thing. I think what does fear do to a person?
His job is fixed for 10 years.
It freezes you.
It
freezes you and it prevents you from what you do know in your heart and mind is the right thing. And the thing that their people are afraid. What are they afraid of? Afraid of loss. What kind of loss? Well, you have to fill in the blank for that. You have to be fearless to the point of basically your life in order to be to do this, to survive it. If you hesitate, it's like running back and forth across I-5. You're going to get smashed.
Could you speak to what you think is the bigger threat or worldwide socialism or worldwide religious?
My premise is the Greens will always devour the Reds because the Reds use other people's resources. And they're always willing to let other people die for what they believe, but they are not willing to die for what they believe themselves. They're willing to sacrifice others, but not, whereas the Greens are, meaning Islam. They will die for what they believe, and that's the subtle distinction.
So that's the biggest.
Yeah, the green will always eat the red. Just like what happened with the perfect illustration is Al-Araba Arabia. Probably never heard that. In English, it's the Arab Spring. It's not actually the Arab Spring. It doesn't mean that in Arabic. It means the Arab revival. Al-Arab, it's a play on words in Arabic. It means the upcoming of the Arabs. Arab happens to be similar to Arab. It's the revival movement to bring back the caliphate. That's what the whole thing was about in the Middle East. But what happened was the Muslim Brotherhood let the young kids with the signs and the energy create the momentum of the fight for change in democracy, right? That's what it was promoted over and over. The Arab Spring is an uprising for democracy, right? That's what we heard over and over and over again. Despite the fact that the leaders of the MD across the Middle East are saying plainly that this is an Arab revival movement that re-implements Sharia law and the caliphate. And as soon as that certain momentum was reached within Egypt, the MD came in and literally drove them off, put them right off the road and took it over. And Morsi implemented Sharia law too fast. And another uprising came, and they pushed him out with al-Sisi's help, and they're all in jail now. But only because he overplayed his hand.
So if that's correct, then do we need a religious war, or Christianity needs to...
Well, in this case, it wasn't done with a war. It was done with an uprising, a popular
revolt. No, I'm saying, do we need, ultimately, do we need another religious war?
Well, ultimately, we have a checks and balances form of government, right? It's created for us to address the challenges that we face within the structure of the principles of the Constitution. The irony of our system is that there's no other option. We either solve our problems within the structure of the Constitution, and the only other option is what? Anarchy and chaos.
Yeah.
We don't have a great mediator in the sky who will come down and help us resolve our problem. It's either follow the constitutional principle or we become a different place than what we know of now. And we are on the verge of descending into chaos and anarchy if that happens. And don't misunderstand me, but that's partly what the Second Amendment is for.
Right.
It's not just to arbitrarily take up arms, because as it says in the Declaration, that experience has shown that mankind are more disposed to suffer while evils are sufferable than to right themselves by abolishing the forms to which they are accustomed. But when a long train of abuses and usurpations pursuing invariably the same object evinces a design to reduce them under absolute despotism, it is their duty to throw off such government. With the understanding, of course, that you do it within the structure of the Constitution, not just arbitrarily. Because that's what it says. Don't be arbitrary about it. But if that protective wall breaks and there's a breach, then we go automatically into chaos and anarchy. By the way, what does the word dainu mean?
No.
Okay, so whatever dainu is, we haven't found it yet, have we? When will a dainu be dainu? When will enough be enough? We haven't got to that point. This rubber band hasn't stretched that much yet. I don't know what it's going to take before we finally say dainu and really mean it.
Yeah, the red line.
Because there's an equation. Fear of being called an Islamophobe, or fear of being called politically incorrect, and other on this side of the equation is fear of attack or fear of jihad. What is the mathematical equation that's in between? Equal, less than, or more than? Right now, I would venture that the fear of being called an Islamophobe or politically incorrect is greater than the fear of an attack. Otherwise, if it wasn't, we'd be responding entirely differently to the attack. So what will it take to turn that equation
around? Let's sell some of your books now.
Yeah.
The theorist air, maybe. No.
Could you comment on how Israel, by comparison, is dealing with this situation?
Much more effectively than we are.
That's